Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 76 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, today I have another excellent guest for you, and fortunately for me, he's another returning one. Last time I spoke with Andreas Baumgartner was way back in episode number 32, where we discussed the ins and outs of negotiating with governments, something that Andreas does on behalf of Free Cities projects for organisations such as the Metis Institute, Praxis, and very relevant in this conversation, Tipolis, which is Titus Gebel's organisation that creates privately run communities. Now, this conversation was recorded during one of our interviews for the Special Economic Zones film that we are producing, and afterwards I continued talking to Andreas about Tipolis and their so-called International Cities project. Now, I've spliced both interviews together, but you may observe that the latter part of the podcast is a bit more question-answer than normal on this podcast. You'll have to forgive me, but I was obviously fishing for sound bites for a film. Nevertheless, I thought there was some good info in there for all you Free Cities people, so I've left it in. Hope you enjoy the dialogue. Andreas is definitely one of the OGs of the space and has more hands-on experience than most. Anyway, now I'm back off to the cutting room floor to wrap up this film, and while I'm doing that, I would highly recommend that you put your phone on airplane mode while you sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Andreas Baumgartner. So yeah, why don't we just start with what is, in your opinion, from your experience, a special economic zone or a free zone, or either one, actually. I mean, they're special economic zones. Free zones are special economic zones. Maybe we should talk about special economic zones.
You could, of course, start with the legal definition of it, but I actually want to start with a very different approach. Special economic zones are zones of opportunity. They are zones of opportunities to do things, to achieve goals that you would find hard to achieve in the so-called mainland areas. And that's, at the end of the day, what special economic zones are about. The legal statute with autonomy, with certain investment incentives and so on, those are all the tools. But at the end of the day, special economic zones are created to achieve economic development, social development, and in certain cases, also political developments, in as far as that they're allowing to test certain concepts, certain models, before rolling them out in a wider context. So that's special economic zones for me, places of opportunity.
Would you say the notion of trying out new ideas, new innovations, new legislations, is that a primary function of special economic zones, or is that just a side effect?
The primary function of special economic zones is to encourage to achieve economic development. That's what it is all about. When talking with governments, which I'm doing a lot, you hear two things that they're looking for: employment opportunities and GDP, i.e. value add to the economy. That's what it is all about. Innovation is a major driver of achieving that growth.
How does a country decide on which trajectory to sort of angle itself? Because economic zones have personalities, right? And they're a reflection of the country, as far as I can tell. So how does a country decide what kind of economic zone to sort of create?
That's a very good question. And well, the important thing for an economic zone to be successful at the end of the day is to have a specific purpose, to have a specific value proposition. We have more than 6,000 zones around the world. Only a small part of them is really, really successful. And what does not work is you just take a piece of land, you put some sort of a nameplate on it, calling it special economic zone, and you think it will work automatically. This will not succeed. All the successful economic zones have been linked into a specific development vision of the country, of the city, of the region they're in. They have been created for a purpose. And it's important to have that differentiated purpose. Whether that's now a traditional zone focusing on logistics, on warehousing, or on the other hand, you know, whether that's a financial center zone, a very sophisticated services zone, that's fine. There's space for all of them. But there is very little chance of success for a zone that does not know what needs it actually wants to cater for.
Talk about Dubai then. What was Dubai's, what problem were the special economic zones solving in Dubai?
In a way, you could say that if you look at the history of Dubai, you are also looking at the history of special economic zones. What I mean with that is if you look at special economic zones over the last 50, 60 years, and I'm oversimplifying now, but economic zones started out as ports. Ports with logistics facilities, increasingly warehousing. The next step of the evolution was manufacturing. At first, some simple assembly, then some actual manufacturing, ever more integrated manufacturing. From that, it took this jump onto services. And the Dubai International Financial Center is a perfect example of that. That was a concept taken from warehousing, logistics, manufacturing to services. And of course, the question is now, the IFC is celebrating its 20th anniversary. What's next? What is the next evolution of special economic zones? Bringing it back to Dubai, which was your question, look at Jebel Ali Free Zone. Jebel Ali is a classic zone in the sense of being based around a port, having value-added services that were initially driven by the port facilities. And the port still space plays a very central role in it. But for Dubai, that was not the full aspiration of the then ruler of Dubai. The aspiration has always been to really put Dubai on the global map. And to do so, not as a matter of many, many decades, but to do so at extremely high speed. And the tool, one of the tools, it's not the only tool, one of the tools chosen was the special economic zone model. And why? Because it really allowed Dubai to offer international investors a familiar environment. Many special economic zones are actually set up as a signal to international investors to give them an environment that they are familiar with. And it's also important that setting up a special economic zone, you know, is not an quote unquote admission of guilt that your mainland system, your legal system, etc., doesn't work. That's not what it is about. You're reaching out to international investors, that have a lot of choice, that can look at different options. So what you want to give them is something that they feel comfortable with, something that they feel they can handle, something that is predictable for them. Predictability is an absolute key term. Predictability, trust. And by setting up those special economic zones, as Dubai has done, for example, with DIFC, it has sent out a very clear message globally. We are here, we are open for business, and we want to have international business. And we are coming your way to make yourself feel as comfortable as possible. And the interesting thing on that is, if you look at the evolution of DIFC, there is a base layer. That base layer is the rules and regulations. that have been designed to really reflect international best practices. But you have then a layer on top of it, which is the physical infrastructure. You know, this needs to be a place that is comfortable, that has enough facilities, that has got all the infrastructure in place. And over the last year, it has added yet another layer, which is the whole lifestyle component. You have an amazing F&B scenes. People are now going to DIFC as a financial center on the evenings, on the weekends, to spend time there. And that has created a community that has attracted people and businesses, not just because of the legal value proposition, which needs to be there, not just because of the financial incentives and so on, which need to be there, not just because of the availability of good offices and infrastructure, but also because people want to be there and people want to be part of that professional and increasingly also social community.
So in the sense of the way you've just described Dubai, how does Dubai innovate its zones? I mean, Dubai, presumably, would you agree Dubai had a somewhat of a first mover advantage? Is that fair to say? In the financial sense, they planted a flag in the desert and said, look, we want to attract financial institutions to us. And it seemed to really work.
They have been extremely ambitious and courageous. I remember some of the early discussions in 2005, right? 2004, 2005. People looked at it like, what are they talking about? What are they doing? You know, what credentials do they have to think of something like that? Well, Dubai just did it. And Dubai took a lot of risk. Let's not overlook that part of it. And yes, to a certain extent, Dubai has also been supported by some of the regional developments, some of the real regional crises, where Dubai was then ready to use the opportunity.
Can you talk a little bit about autonomy? It was leading into it in that last section. What kind of autonomy on a spectrum? Is there too much autonomy? Is there a sweet spot with autonomy? And in your opinion, how should governments position themselves with regard to autonomy?
I think the first important point is autonomy is a tool to achieve something. We should never speak of autonomy just for autonomy's sake. The objective is always to create an environment that attracts businesses, that attracts investment, and that attracts people. That's what we are talking about. And in many cases, a certain degree of autonomy is an important element of the toolkit to achieve that. Not less, not more. To your question around, is there a sweet spot on the level of autonomy? I do not think there is a globally applicable sweet spot of autonomy. It's always autonomy relative to the circumstances you're operating in. There may be environments where the government decides, yes, we really want to catch up. We don't only want to catch up, we want to leapfrog. And we really want to send a signal that we are serious about very significant reform, realizing that in country we still have very significant issues. In such a context, the degree of autonomy required to be perceived as credible internationally is likely to be higher. There might be other environments where you actually say, look, things are actually going very well, and it's an attractive environment anyway. There are just, you know, some levers that we want to adjust. So the relative degree of autonomy is probably a bit lower in such an environment. And actually, if you're looking, for example, at the United Arab Emirates here that we're in, there are so many developments that are now applying not just to the free zones. So many innovations from free zones have been taken over by the mainland economies, that actually some people would be arguing that the need for additional autonomy is actually getting smaller over time.
Would you say that if you look at the spectrum of zones over time, is there an evolution occurring?
This is a very good question. I do think we're seeing waves, if I may put it this way. You have a wave of innovation, and those innovations typically require high degrees of autonomy because it's about trying out new things, entering untested waters. And designating an autonomous zone, a special zone, has the advantage that you can try it out there without immediately jumping totally into the cold pool, so to speak. So whenever there's a phase of innovation, you require autonomy. You then see over time that those innovations are more and more adopted and adapted by the surrounding economies, so that the immediate need for autonomy goes down a bit until the next wave of innovation comes.
Do you see any waves of innovation on the horizon?
Well, yes, I do. If you look at the last big wave of innovation, you could argue that this was the transition from special zones being a pure logistics and manufacturing concept to being a services-related concept. That was about 20 years ago. The IFC is celebrating its 20th anniversary. What's next? I personally believe that what we are going to see as the next evolution of special economic zones is integrated autonomous cities with their own statute that allows them to offer targeted and tailored living and working environments to people internationally, but also from their respective home regions. And that's very exciting because we are really at this stage where this old split between working world and living world doesn't exist anymore. It doesn't hold anymore. It's coming together. All of us are working, or many of us are working from home partially, right? We are way more mobile. Special economic zones that are empty deserts during the weekend, during the evenings, that's a waste of real estate. That's a waste of resources. Let's make them really livable and living centers of activities, hubs of activities. That's the next horizon I'm seeing.
Can you describe what that looks like in reality? Describe an autonomous city setup. I'm a resident. What is it like for me as a resident?
For you as a resident, it should be a place where you can live to your fullest potential, where you can have a great life as a private individual with your family, with your partner, in whichever way you choose to organize your life, and at the same time find ample opportunity to also thrive economically. Or if you're more interested in, you know, arts or anything like that, give you the space to realize that drive. Now, the interesting thing is what I've just described, you could say, well, isn't this exactly what cities have done for, not just for centuries, but millennia in a way? And the answer to that is yes. It is exactly that. It's this hub function. So in a way, you could say this is pretty much one of the oldest industries of the world, right? Developing cities. What is new? What is new, in a way, is that we now have new means of technology. We have new working models that give many of us, not all, way more flexibility. And those autonomous cities, international cities, are an opportunity to cater to people who really want to live to their fullest potential. And that way, and I think this is an important point, innovate and contribute to the economy of the host country.
My first thought when I think of pitching the idea of an autonomous city to a government is they're going to be scared of the word autonomous. What is it about an autonomous city that a government should embrace? Because obviously on a surface level, that looks like that they're relinquishing control, power, maybe even land.
As you know, in my role, I'm talking with a lot of governments. The question is not, Do you want an autonomous city? Do you want a free city? Do you want a private city? Do you want an international city? Whatever you want to call it. That's not the question. The question, the conversation to have is around, what are your economic aspirations, your social development aspirations, to a certain extent also your political aspirations? What do you want to do with your country? Where do you see it stand? What do you want to achieve? That's the first discussion. And then the question becomes, does a special economic zone concept, does an autonomous city concept allow and contribute to realizing that vision and ambition? And in some cases, in many cases, we believe it does. But it is one tool in a toolbox.
Do you have a longer term idea of, say, I know this is difficult, but say 50 years' time, describe the landscape, the landscape of zones according to you, or according to what you perceive would be an innovative future, let's say?
We already have more than 6,000 special economic zones of all kind of shapes, sizes, and degree of success. My vision is that in 50 years' time, the really successful zones, or special regions, as they are sometimes referred to, will be those integrated places of living, working, and also rejuvenating. I think that's also a very important element in it. My vision is a network of cities that are cooperating, that are putting the interests of their residents first, that are giving freedom to develop, and at the same time also linking into existing cities. This is not, in my eyes, any attempt to replace existing cities, nor should it be. It's an additional complementary offering in a world where this network of places will become more and more important.
What's your, you speak to a lot of governments specifically about these things. So when you're approaching a new government, or when you're invited to consult on a new, with a new government or a leader, what's your best advice on the establishment of a zone, if it's something that a country's never done before?
My first advice is, let's actually stop talking about a specific city or a specific zone, and let's first talk about what you want to achieve, where you want your country to stand in 20, 30, 40 years. And only once we have defined that ambition, then let's talk about how a city or a zone can help you achieve that aspiration.
And I'd like to dig a bit deeper again. How does that government then decide on, I mean, actually, out of interest, are you part of the helping them to decide what it is they actually want, or do they come to you already knowing what they want?
So I'm coming from an economic development background, and a lot of the work I'm actually doing with governments, or have done with governments, is exactly around that, trying to distill the vision for the future and translating that into some specific positioning and some specific aspiration. And I actually came to the whole special economic zone and private city, autonomous city world from that economic development angle. That's, so to speak, my home. So where the zones are coming in is a tool that we are offering to governments, that we are offering to people. I think that is very important. The zones should never, ever be something that is kind of parachuted into country and then forms an exclave or anything. It should also not be something that is pushed onto people, onto residents in a certain area. It needs to be part of the overall fabric. That's the only way it is going to be acceptable and it's going to be successful. So I know that in some discussions around citizen development, you know, they're saying, oh, yeah, no, 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 we have to do things differently. And yes, it's important to do things differently. Zones offer a great opportunity to innovate on governance models, to innovate on regulatory regimes, to innovate on service delivery. All of that is true. But we are not, and we should never do it against governments. We should do it together with governments, and even more importantly, with the people who are already living in that area. It needs to be a joint effort to be acceptable and to become successful.
Can I ask you what, when you observe the spectrum of zones, and I'm referring to even Prospera and Morazan here, what would you say is at the cutting edge of the wedge in zones currently?
The cutting edge of zones at the moment is zones that have a very clear value proposition, international recognition, that are catering not just to work, but increasingly also to lifestyle needs, and that do all of that in a predictable and reliable way. Now, I might be biased because I have lived here in the Middle East for 20 years. I've had a lot of exposure to Dubai International Financial Center, but I would argue that at this stage, the IFC and some of the other zones here are really at the leading edge. That being said, I think it's up to all of us to say, great model, what else can we do? What more can we do? What is on the horizon? And I'm really looking forward to working with people, working with governments, working with private investors to shape that next rejuvenation of special economic zones. And when I say rejuvenation, I really mean it, because in a way, we have all come to accept certain paradigms. And that's great because it has created a model that can be copied. But just accepting paradigms and doing them gradually better, yes, you're improving, but you're not creating something really new. How can we create something really new? That's by moving beyond existing paradigms and try out the next generation. In my point of view, those integrated cities, to achieve those innovations, to be able to break the existing paradigms, that's where autonomy will come in as an absolutely crucial tool, because it is autonomy that allows you to try those new concepts and to implement them in a way that investors, that individuals who you want to attract to your zone can actually trust.
Well, I actually heard some stats from Vera about this, and maybe you know, I don't know. But describe the difference in reality between privately run and publicly run zones, and which you perceive as better or not.
Actually, if you look at most zones, you have a very, very interesting mixture. I would argue that there are very few that are purely private, and there are few that are purely public. You have a lot of special economic zones that are, that you would consider public from, or semi-public from an ownership structure, but that you would definitely consider private from a management culture perspective.
Better or worse?
I think it's the combination of both. You want to have those private sector management practices, the dynamics, the strive for innovation from a classic private sector mindset. On the other hand, I actually do think it's helpful to have the host country involved in some sort, because it creates buy-in. It creates skin in the game.
I might just go back to something that we was talking about at the beginning, which is the trend of zones. Can you describe that trend historically and then suggest how that trend might evolve from here?
If you look at the development of special economic zones, it started out around ports. seaports typically, a bit later airports. And the first logic development was inclusion of logistics facilities, warehousing. Once you have warehousing in place, it's kind of the logic next evolution that you start some assembly, some light manufacturing. And once you have manufacturing, light manufacturing in place, you're going towards more and more integrated manufacturing, ending up with some pretty complex manufacturing zones. If you, for example, look at some of the Moroccan zones in the aerospace industry, in the automotive industry. But all of those are still around handling, manipulating physical goods. Those were the first phases: ports, warehousing, manufacturing. About 20, 25 years ago, discussion started. Does the concept actually apply to services? And this is where, for example, DIFC came in as one of the earliest pioneers, taking a concept that was designed for the physical handling, the physical manipulation of goods, to something as abstract as financial services. And there were a lot of people who said, come on, that doesn't work. It did work. And it started the trend of complementing the traditional economic zones with services zones. And that's important. It complemented it. It added areas of application to the special economic zone concept. It did not replace the concept. There are extremely successful logistics zones. There are extremely successful manufacturing zones. And now there are also very, very successful services zones. But the question is, if the services zones came into being or started coming into being about 20 years ago, where do we go from here? What is the next layer that we can put on top of port, logistics, manufacturing, services? The layer that is still there is integrated cities. Cities that serve your working needs, that serve your living needs, that serve your rejuvenation needs.
Is it fair to say that, according to you, the special economic zone is an essential part of the toolkit of a nation? Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think that is fair to say. It has proven to be a very effective part of the toolkit of nations, but only if it was taken seriously, if it is taken seriously. To succeed, it is not enough to just call it a special economic zone. You need the purpose. You need a regulatory regime that is really tailored to the specific purpose. You need the communication and international positioning to let people know about it, to create a hype about it, no doubts about that. And last but definitely not least, you need consistency and predictability. Special economic zones stand and fall with living up to the promises that are made to investors and that are made to people moving towards it.
Can you cite any particular examples of when special economic zones failed and why?
Absolutely. Bear with me that I do not want to shame and blame any specific zones, but if you look at zones that have struggled and that have not been successful, it typically comes down, in my eyes, to two or three factors. Factor one is it was not clear from the outset what they wanted to achieve. Factor two is they promised a lot and then didn't live up to it and disappointed people. And factor three is they were successful at the beginning, thought they had discovered gold, leaned back and stopped innovating, and the train moved on.
When you sort of observe the globe, where are the greatest opportunities in free zones, according to you?
If you're looking at the moment, I still feel that the Middle East is on top of the game with a lot of new innovations still coming up. I actually think we'll see a lot in Southeast Asia, as well as increasingly in Central Asia, and also in Africa, where this is a great opportunity to really accelerate economic development. I assume also for Latin America, it's a very interesting model, but that is not my area of special expertise. Now, the thing that I am wondering about is there a role for special economic zones in what's usually referred to as the established first world countries? Is there a role for economic zones in the United States of America, Canada? Is there a role for special economic zones in the UK, where they're starting to experiment with those free ports? Is there a role for special economic zones in the European Union? In my opinion, for those countries, and I'm originating from one of those countries, to remain competitive, we need to stop being arrogant about those zones and looking down on countries that are adapting the zones model. Because if we are not starting to use the model to innovate in those traditional countries, if I may call them that way, we will see others really surpass us, take opportunity, and take the jobs.
Do you think the brain drain is a real thing? I mean, when you look at your own country or the UK, America, is that a real thing?
It is real in the sense that talent has an incredible degree of mobility. Of mobility of physically moving and also of communicating globally. So yes, it is a global trend. At the same time, I'm not joining the choir of all of those singing that Europe and the United States are just going down the drain. I think that's wrong. The question that we should be asking ourselves is, how can we use all those examples we're seeing around the world? How can we use those tools that are so successful elsewhere to bring them back into Europe, to bring them into the United States and really use it to become leaders and innovators again? And I really hope, you know, that this model of cities that we're all thinking of, that we're all dreaming of, is not causing a drain on Europe, is causing an exodus from Europe, but that very differently, it's bringing people together who will hopefully find an environment that inspires them and then hopefully, you know, brings that spark of innovation back into countries that are currently a little bit on the depressive side.
I was going to say, my experience of Europe, certainly of the UK where I'm from, is not one of hope. It's funny, I've been to countries where the hope is palpable and where the excitement and where the energy is rising. And that's not the case in my own country. Is that something you've experienced?
Yeah. I left Europe about 20 years ago, came to the Middle East, and then over the 20 years to quite a number of regions. What I found in the Middle East, in Asia, is an incredible dynamic that gives opportunities that I might not have had in the same way back in my home country. That being said, this shouldn't be an easy excuse of all of us running away. I really see the autonomous city movement as an opportunity to reinvigorate Europe, the United States, and to do that as part of a global network with African cities as equal partners, with Asian cities as equal partners, American cities as equal partners. Wouldn't that be an amazing vision?
Okay, describe what an international city is like then. How does it operate?
An international city is building on the so-called free private city model. The idea is to create special zones with their own governance that create spaces for residents and businesses to live, work, and prosper. That's the idea. And to do it as autonomous zones, but under the umbrella and in cooperation, in partnership with host governments that share this vision of enabling people to achieve their potential and thereby creating economic and social development.
As a resident, what do I need to know? What makes this any different from me moving to a traditional city?
As a resident, we aspire to offer you an attractive living environment at very competitive rates. It has to address both your heart and your mind. You, as an individual, will have a contract with the city, with the city operator. You will have a contract that clearly spells out your rights and your obligations. That contract that you sign also spells out the rights and responsibilities of the city operator. And because it is a contract, no side can just unilaterally change that contract. And not only that, but this contract-based model actually allows you to go into dispute resolution if one of the two sides, yourself or the city operator, doesn't live up to it. And that's putting you into a very, very different position than in a traditional city. You are a contract partner. And the city operator, who is your partner, needs to live up to its promises. Because otherwise, you have potentially a legal remit, or you can just move on.
I think a lot of people would say that I'm okay in the traditional model. What would you say would make this a better proposition than living in London and abiding by the rules of the democratic system, for example?
I don't think this is a question of whether you want to live in a democratic system or not. The city's offering is a complementary offering. And you may actually, over the course of your life, right, spend some time in traditional cities, move into one of those new, hopefully international cities, and then move on again or move within a network. So it's not an either or. It's complementary to the existing offering. That being said, what we do hope to provide, and that's our aspiration why we're doing it, is to create that inspiring environment, an environment where you're not bogged down by all sort of bureaucracy to live your dream and realize your potential. That's the targeted vision. And there are cities that are better in it. There's traditional cities that are worse in it.
What is the obligation of the city operator?
The obligation of the city operator is to provide the basic framework of safety, security, stability within you as an individual can operate in a predictable and reliable way in which you and your family can live, but also an environment within which you can decide which additional offerings you actually want to go for. So you're not forced into taking the all-inclusive package. It's your choice.
Would you say a key aspect of international cities or autonomous cities is voluntarily opting into them?
As an international city, Petipolis, we need to attract you. And we will only attract you if we can offer you what you need. We're living in a world where services are more and more differentiated and consumers are given choice. This idea of consumer choice we're bringing to the city model.
According to you, what are the key elements of private governance that make it a very attractive version of governance?
The key elements are a private governance model is based on contract. So you have rights and obligations that are enforceable and that cannot be changed unilaterally. Second, setting up a new governance model, greenfield, actually allows us to create a model that is enabling rather than constraining. And third, it really allows us to do so using all those fascinating technological opportunities that allow for interaction in ways that we could not have dreamed of just years ago.
More often than not these days, we see people as subjects of government. You're suggesting that citizens will be paying customers.
Residents are paying customers of a commercially operating city operator.
What are the main opportunities for governments or leaders who are choosing to implement this particular model?
We are offering to governments a partnership that develops economic opportunity and social opportunity within their country in full respect of the culture and the specific environment of the country. We offer to governments an opportunity to really put themselves on the global map as highly innovative and as a place that is attracting global talent and merging global talent with local talent for the benefit of the host country.
Can I ask you about design of international cities? What needs to be considered in designs, and what lessons have we learned from traditional cities, according to you, to help us build a 21st century city from scratch?
When building those cities, we're focusing on the people. We're focusing on the individuals. We're not trying to create concrete deserts. We're not trying to create cookie-cutter layouts that could be anywhere in the world. We're focused on creating authentic experiences that combine international attractiveness and local flavor, tradition, culture, because that combination really makes it rich. Speaking very practically, it is about cities that give space to people, space to live, space to work, space to rejuvenate. It is about cities that have very, very strong infrastructure, but in a very discreet and often hidden way. We are talking about cities that are comfortable to live in, that are inspiring to live in, but without necessarily over showcasing all that it takes in the background to function.
Can you go a little bit deeper into the architecture of it? Are you saying that you'll be taking reference from the host country when you're considering architecture?
I think we should be taking a reference from the host country, because the whole idea of an international city is not to create some strange foreign territory in the host country. It's about combining the best of international experience, international aspiration, with the best of local culture.
What will you consider in city design?
A well-designed city should be a city that is clearly recognizable as an international city by Dipolis, yet at the same time clearly recognizable as a city of its host countries. It's merging the international city standard elements with local culture, local vibes, local environment, so that when you come to an international city by Tipolis as a resident or as a visitor, you immediately know and feel, yes, this is an international city. But at the same time, you also immediately know, now I'm in Africa, or now I'm in Latin America, in Asia, in Europe.
For whom are you building these cities? Who is your target group?
We are building our cities for humans. We're building our cities for people who are looking for a great place to be at, to live at, to work at. We're looking for people who want to come, join our communities, and contribute to those communities. Some of them will be global nomads. Others might be from the host country. It's the combination of both that we're aiming for. And we're really looking for diversity. a real city needs to be a melting pot. It needs to be a melting pot of a variety of influences. You don't want those sterile artificial developments. You want to have excitement. That's why you need people with different backgrounds socially, different backgrounds culturally, different backgrounds in terms of life expectations and experiences. You want cities that are full of life with artists, with businessmen, with families, with elderly people, with young people. The worst thing that could happen if we just create a sterile, monotonic environment. That's not what cities are about. Cities need to be exciting. Cities need to be vibrant. Cities need to be diverse. This is what we are aspiring to create.
What about the notion of new frontiers? Could you see international cities by Tipolis as new frontiers, or is that a stretch?
They are certainly new frontiers in terms of testing out governance concepts, like the concept of everything being based on contract. At the same time, we're balancing the new frontier feeling with the familiarity feeling. We don't want to give a new frontier feeling just for the purpose of being new frontier. At the end of the day, it's about giving people an environment that they can thrive in, enabling that environment, partially through innovation, and we're very, very strong on that component, be it through governance, be it through architectural concepts, be it through the whole area of services. But at the same time, we also recognize and appreciate the value of familiarity, of predictability.
When is this going to happen?
We are already in specific negotiations with a number of governments. I'm very, very confident that we will see the first international cities coming up over the course of the coming years.
Would you say that international cities are somewhat of this age, of this time in history? We have this opportunity now of mobility. It's quite new. You know, you can live in Dubai and you can go and work in London and come back to Dubai if you really want to. These kind of opportunities are very contemporary. Would you say international cities are riding this wave and they are of this time and this is now the right time?
They are definitely of this time. We're definitely not just riding on this wave. I think we're riding on the very edge of the wave. At the same time, cities have been built for centuries, for millennia. So we're in this exciting position to be at the very cutting edge on one hand, and on the other hand, being involved in something that has been a desire for humankind since the very first day, the desire to create communities in which we feel home.
Do you believe that this is a natural evolutionary step of the SEZ model?
Absolutely. If you look at the special economic zone model, it started out with ports. It went into logistics. From there, it gradually evolved into assembly, light manufacturing, more complex manufacturing, as we are now seeing, for example, in Morocco or in certain zones in China. The next layer added to that was services zones. Dubai International Financial Center being an example, an early example of such a financial service zone. So what is next? What is this next level of integration, this next layer to add? Yes, I'm absolutely convinced it's integrated cities that cater to the needs of their residents, to their professional needs, and to their lifestyle needs. And that's what International Cities by Tipolis are offering. Tipolis is building privately governed, autonomous communities that come together in cities as their physical location.
Okay. Thank you.
We're done. Perfect.